to the Training Babble podcast. I'm your host, Dave Schell, and today I have the joy of being joined by the Gravel God again. Maddie, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure, Dave. Thanks for the invite.
So if you're not familiar with Maddie, Maddie's a coach. His name is Maddie Rowe, and he is the owner of Gravel God Cycling or Gravel God Coaching. And we did an episode a couple months ago, and I can't remember what the title was. I don't know if it's Cycling Myths We Wish Would Die, or maybe it was the problem with indoor training.
Yes, rants about indoor training.
Yeah, exactly. And so we had so much fun ranting about indoor training that when we were off, when we weren't recording anymore, we had talked about the need to talk about specificity in training and, you know, beyond FTP and trying to get all the power numbers up and all that stuff. Like, how do you really train for the demands of a race and some things that people typically miss? So with that, I guess let's just define what is specificity from your standpoint.
To me, it's making sure your training is mimicking the demands of the event you wish to do well in your training. And that can catch people off guard. One thing I like to point out, at least in some of my writing, is that you have like heart, lungs, blood, all that stuff. And everything that like all endurance athletes share, like is helpful to increasing your endurance, increasing your aerobic power. So especially in the winter, I think it's great when athletes cross train and branch out, maybe, well, don't snowshoe, but, you know, do a little running, cross country skiing, all the things that keep it fresh, maybe keep you from just being in your basement all season. And that, like, while it's not specific to riding your bike, if you do lots of volumes of other aerobic based training, it's not going to, like, it's not like you're bowling. Like, there is some carryover. The central aspects that make you an endurance athlete do carry over pretty well. Now, the like periphery aspects, so like your muscle activation and like the movement patterns, all that stuff, that does really matter. So in general, the closer you get to a, you know, your bike race, the more you want your training, like you don't want to, like, for example, I'll share something that's killing me right now. We just got a bunch of, snow. I bought a season pass to Eldorado cross country ski. I haven't used it as much as I want. And the snow is great, but I have a really big race in 3 weeks. And I know the last thing I need is to go up and do more cross country skiing. It's good aerobic work, but it also makes me tired in a non-specific way to the event that I want to do well in. So I have to like try my best to fight my instinct to like not go up to Eldora and cross country ski and instead do very specific intervals for specific durations that I expect to encounter in this race instead. And so that's a good example. But however, if it was 3 months ago and the snow was great and I had the time, I wouldn't hesitate for a second to go up and just go cross country ski because I have 3 months to, you know, get more specific in my training and it wouldn't hurt that much. So that's my, would you say that's a good overview of specificity?
And I think you just touched on a really important concept is that when we talk about periodization, like people, you can really get into the weeds defining periodization and people have all these different schemes that they might use and stuff, but really at the very basis of periodization, it's like, do the least specific training further out from the race, do the most specific training closer to the race. And so like you just said, when we're talking, I probably overly simplify this, but when I'm working with people, I kind of look at it like 70 to 80% of the year is just building general fitness. And then the 20 to 30% of the year is like making it specific to the demands of the event. And so like you said, with skiing, it's like, yeah, you could be skiing, you could be swimming, you could be running, you could be doing all these things and it's contributing to general fitness. But once you get within a certain time window, and for me, I've always felt like 3 months is kind of when I really want to start focusing on it. Then we want to be specific. And some of the things that I harp on, and these are like, we're going to discuss all these, but I think like just being on the bike that you're going to be using. So it's like, if I'm coaching a time trialist or somebody that's going to be racing time trials, but they're doing all their workouts inside on their road bike, sitting straight up, like that's not going to transfer. Like all of a sudden you get out to do a race and you just don't have the power, your back's hurting, your neck's hurting, everything else. And so it's so important from all aspects to really like, practice how, like train how you race, race how you train.
Yeah. And sort of skipping ahead to, yeah, specificity covers so many things. Like what I started touching off on was like the actual like physiological aspect of it. But to your point, it really covers all of it. And I think especially if you read case studies on people training for, I don't know, the Olympics, let's say, and they release the course. Well, you know, somebody we both know, like Jim Miller,
right?
He will go to excruciating detail to replicate the exact demands of that course. Like take a time trial, for example, he'll say, okay, you know, there's this early climb and then you have to do this. It'd be competitive. We need to hit it at these watts per kilograms, blah, blah, blah. So then the athlete is going out, as you were saying, they're not training in their basement, like upright on the different bike. Like they're going out there, sometimes in some cases traveling to a specific spot, you know, fueling the way they would fuel, being in the equipment that they're going to race in, you know, absent maybe the race wheels and stuff like that. And then like trying to hit those efforts. And you can get a long way on general fitness, but in a sport that is in sport, endurance sports, when like little margins matter a lot, you know, a lot of workouts or sessions, you know, targeting very specific demands, not just the physiological, but the technical demands, the nutritional demands, transitional demands, as we'll touch on later, make a big difference. And then once that gets automatic, you know, once you build up a tolerance for that stress, your chances of performing better go up a lot compared to somebody who's just, you know, treading water or bowling or getting their heart rate up.
Right. And so I guess just to like frame that, like why does specificity matter? Again, we've already kind of touched on it a little bit. Like we're currently in a spot where power meters are like, everybody has a power meter. Everybody's got a smart trainer. It's super popular. So everybody's hyper aware of the metrics. And so metrics will get you, like can certainly get you far. But I think from my perspective, specificity matters because it's like you said, the practical application of those metrics to the demands of your event. And so regardless of what type of event we're talking about, there's going to be very specific demands, whether, you know, like, I guess my example here is roadies can show up at a mountain bike race and just crush it. But if it's a really technical course, they tend to struggle if they don't spend a lot of time on their mountain.
Yes.
Bike.
Yes.
So when does it not matter?
I would say it doesn't matter if you haven't done the 75 to 85% of general conditioning. I think you have to build your body to the point where, like, because a lot of specificity is like intensity or holding your body in a position that might be pretty challenging. And like base work isn't just non-specific base work isn't just sort of a theory. I mean, it is a theory, but I think I see the way that it plays out with people who try to skip that and get too cute with being too specific or too intense without doing the groundwork beforehand is some of the obvious things like injury. But a lot of times it manifests to me as a coach, mostly in like mood and burnout. There's a big difference between like surviving a workout and sort of absorbing and adapting to it. And on paper, like if we peer in our Training Peaks calendars and see green's better than red, but you really do have to dive in and see what's going on and really like harp on your athletes to give feedback on how it felt, because the little differences between hey, I like barely made the bottom of the zone, which should be in theory, like totally within my ability. And hey, this was easy, but you know, hey, I was even holding back because I'm a good athlete and wanted to follow your instructions. That's a huge difference there, but it can look green both ways. So to answer your question, if you don't, specificity doesn't matter if your general fitness isn't like good enough to support it. And that also goes for in the gym. You know, you were speaking about like time trials and people's backs and whatever, failing them. Well, you know, part of that solution is riding your time trial bike, but another part of it is you sit, most people sit almost all the time. And that, you know, that like that, like my favorite place that I found you in Training Peaks once, up against a wall with your arms spread akimbo, trying to push up and your back just shaking. And I didn't think that looked hard. And then I tried it and I was even more pathetic than you. So yeah, both muscularly and yeah, cardiovascularly, preparing yourself to handle the demands of the specificity.
Yeah, and I'll just add, like I think one time it doesn't matter, and this, and you can add to this, or correct me if you think I'm wrong, but I think in virtual racing, specificity doesn't like, and we see it. Like, I think people can get away with a lot of stuff there because you're just not having to deal with wind and stuff like that. And so you're seeing people be successful. But I think of this one example. I think she was from Rose Beast Mode or something. And she was like racing like 6 watts per kilo and everybody started accusing her of cheating. And they like came out with this big response. And like what it turned out to be is she was able to just like ride out of the saddle the entire time. She just figured out how to like put out another watt per kilo by standing the entire time. Right. And then like, but that would never fly in the real world.
That's an interesting strategy. Maybe I'll try it at my race.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right. And so, so I think that's where like, and I think that's where a lot of this has come from, is that people get super fit inside in the winter and then go to race and maybe have a shitty race. And it's because they didn't apply that fitness.
Yes, I agree.
So let's talk about like some of the ways you can be specific. And I feel like there's so many things, but it, like, I'll start with some of the things that I see. I already mentioned like riding the correct bike. I also think like the correct grade. And what I mean by that is if somebody, let's say somebody's got, the example I'll use is there's a race in Michigan called the Moran 166, and it's just like pancake flat. So like, I think 2000 feet of gain over 166 miles.
Wow.
And we would be really hard pressed to find that here. Right. But like, as I was preparing for that, I went out of my way and tried to ride, just pedaled lots and lots of pedaling without brakes, because I knew that I was going to be pedaling lots without brakes, versus some people might just like start riding up the canyons and like doing hill repeats and stuff like that. And what I found is that grade matters, and that we produce power a little bit differently. And so riding up a 6% grade and then coasting back down and doing that over and over again isn't the same as riding a 2% grade for 4 hours.
Definitely not. Yeah. Changes the power application. And I think, as you're pointing out, you can do a 6-hour ride in the mountains, but if you actually look at pedaling time, it could be 4 hours.
Right. And high torque, right? Like 60% right. of it's going to be really high torque, and the other part's going to be coasting versus just sitting on a gear for hours at 85 to 90 RPM.
Yeah. Riding in Florida really opened my eyes to that. It's astonishing how little elevation you can actually gain over a piece of land until you go to Florida and you realize you could go for a 60-mile ride and gain 400 feet, most of it over one freeway pass.
Yeah.
And it's just interminable. You're just like pedaling and pedaling and pedaling, and it slowly kind of adds up. Cause if you're doing more variable riding, you know, those brakes definitely help. Like, you don't realize it as you're doing it. You think, I just climbed 2000 feet. Yeah. Well, you also got a 10-minute break, didn't you?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's exactly. And I think the difference here is, like, you and I both live in Colorado. We go out and ride and it's typically pretty rolly. And so we're getting little mini breaks here and there. Well, if you stop pedaling on something flat, you're not coasting. You come to a stop, especially if you're like working against a headwind. And so you just don't get those breaks. And so yeah, that's another piece that I think specificity matters, in that, like, thinking about the terrain you're going to be riding or racing on and trying to mimic that. Just going back to the bike, like, yes, I think bike position matters, but even something as small as, like, where are the bottle cages, right? We create this mental map of where things are located and how to shift and, like, things like that. And if you haven't spent time on that bike, you might end up dropping a bottle because you're trying to put it in the bottle cage and it's not where you think it is. And that's going to cost you. So just, yeah, I think that's a really, like, basic level of specificity there.
Basic, but so often overlooked.
Yeah.
I'd like to back up and say, just mention, like, a really big picture thing. I think one of the biggest changes when you're becoming more specific from maybe a general preparation is, in general preparation, I think it's more okay to focus, if you consider the concept of, like, workload versus work rate. And when you're building, when you're preparing for a season, just, like, building your various systems, just essentially what you're doing is getting your body to adapt to taking on lots of stress. And that can look really impressive in terms of training hours or metrics, if you're familiar with CTL. I know you are, Dave, but I'm just saying people listening. CTL, stuff like that. And people can chase that blue line. And, you know, that can be okay. You still want to, like, work in, you know, you want to do overload, you want to work in rest, but you can generally, like, do a lot and you can get really strong, like super strong. You can do a century, you know, without tapering for, without too much preparation. You can do hard stuff. But I think as you're getting into, like, actually going fast, you have to, and this is very hard, but you have to switch your mentality to more, like, work rate focused. So, like, one thing that I'm in the midst of doing constantly, I'm slapping so many hands. I need to invest in a, what's it called? A cudgel, something like that, a slapper, because I have lots of athletes who they've built up a beautiful workload, this great base that we can work off of for most of the season. And then I say, okay, if, like, your intervals that you're doing every week, if you're not hitting them, or, like, there's some weird mismatch heart rate to output, like, we're going to have to take more rest. And a couple of things I've noticed, some people handle it well, of course, there's different responses, but some people, they don't. And so that tells me we need to take the workload down a little bit. You need to be able to hit these intervals. You're too tired. You're carrying too much fatigue, which, of course, is this a fun conversation to have? No, because they feel like they're giving up all their hard work, and they're not giving, they're just, like, you know, maybe it means a day off or shortening a 2-hour ride to a 1-hour ride, stuff like that, like being very disciplined within the zones, especially on endurance days, focusing on work rate and then seeing phenomenal results when they finally can let go of maintaining a super high CTL, you know, through everything. And, oh, I'm nailing intervals now. And not only am I nailing intervals, but this is starting to feel like I feel so good when I'm doing it, because we've given up putting so much energy into just being able to do more and more and more. You can finish on that. Sometimes you can perform okay on that, but especially for events like criteriums or shorter stuff where it's less about, where it's more like work rate limited versus, like, workload limited, more like an unbound, you really need to stop chasing CTL, stop chasing workload, and give your body a chance to both execute super hard workouts, which are hard and take a long time to recover from.
And just as you're talking about that, I think the way I've always looked at that is you have to sharpen at some point, right? And like you said, you can get away with a blunt instrument at unbound and stuff like that, because it's typically not going to come down to a sprint or like some move that, like, blows it wide open. there's going to be lots of moves over the course of the day. And it's really that staying power that's going to determine the winner versus a crit or a mountain bike, a short mountain bike race or something like that. It's going to be a very decisive move that like creates a gap and people can't make it up. So yeah, I agree with that. And I do think, and I don't want to turn this into another CTL thing, but, but I think it's important to talk about is like, I think that's what happened when Training Peaks started calling chronic training load fitness is everybody wants their fitness to be higher. And so you never want that blue line to come down. But like you just said, it's like, it's okay. Like, I guess the way I've always looked at it, especially with coaching cyclocross, is we want to get that blue line as high as possible right before the season. And then 8 to 12 weeks, like really specific intensity going into the season. And that blue line's going to fall, but that doesn't mean that like you're not winning races. And then maybe like if it's a long season, we'll take a break halfway through that season and do an aerobic block, like 1 to 2 weeks again, just to like try to get the blue line up again and then finish out the season. But it's also good to take a break from the intensity for a little bit. And so,
yeah,
great point there.
It's great marketing, but man, is it deceiving?
Yeah. Well, exactly. Right. It's how you interpret it. And I like, if you look at it at face value, but, so just to continue on our specificity thing, I think, like I mentioned bikes, stuff like that. We mentioned time trial position. I think this whole conversation started between you and I, when we were just talking about like not riding in the drops. So if you are going to do something like Unbound and you're doing all your training sitting upright, but you're going to go do this race where you like are going to be facing lots of wind and everything. And maybe you do have aero bars. If you don't, like if you're going to be riding in the drops a lot of time, you need to prepare for that also. So what are some other, like, let's use Unbound as an example. What are some other, examples of specificity there that people might not be thinking
number
about.
Number one by far is dealing with thermal stress, heat for sure. People can live in colder places or just don't like just underestimate the effect of, let's call it an average Unbound day, which isn't like last year where it rained and didn't really get above 80. It's like 2 years ago when it was 90 to 95. And people don't understand their sweat rates. They have very little exposure. And then that's when you have the mythical Unbound moments of, you know, buying real estate under a tree and just lying there for hours. Getting sauna time. I have this workout where I will have my athletes like finish the last 90 minutes without drinking and then wait a little bit and then gradually sip. Getting their sodium intake dialed. And in some cases that can be an extreme, performance enhancer. So matching your nutritional and hydrational strategies to the weather that you're going to experience at the race. And, you know, chiefly as we're transitioning from winter to, you know, late spring to summer, heat is the biggest one. And it puts people back the most, catches them by surprise. They don't think about it, but it's just a huge limiter. And you have to train in weirdly specific ways, but you know, that's one of those adaptations your body can fairly rapidly acquire in a very positive way. So a little goes a long way. I think as far as like the saunas and the over clothing and that sort of thing, getting your sweat rate dialed in is more of experimentation, but safe to say that most people could benefit from starting at 500 milligrams, you know, in their bottle on a hot day to start off with. I go way over the top. What I figured out, for example, I kept cramping. When I first started doing gravel, my first one was Unbound, but then that year I did BWR California, and it was, I think it got to 100 during the day with high humidity, and I'm pretty sure I almost died, and I've never cramped so much in my life. When I finished, it looked like I had been taken and dumped in a vat of like salty solution and pulled back out. Like it was just, my entire bibs are just crusted. And I realized, hey, I'm probably a really heavy, salty sweater. So I take down 1500 milligrams, in my water bottles for the first 3 or 4 hours. Mm. And ever since I've done that, never cramp, no catastrophic explosions, nothing like that. So I think, yeah, that's another, I would say that's probably one of the most important specific things you could do for Unbound, because it's not going to rain every year.
Yeah. And like I said, you and I live in Colorado, and something I forget about each year is how we make this jump from winter to spring or winter to summer over like a week. And so right now is the perfect example. I think it snowed 2 days ago and it's supposed to be 80 degrees on Tuesday. And so it's essentially a jump in like 40 degrees. And so we've had no preparation to like ease us into that. And it's something we forget about. And I hate when that happens to athletes at races. And so something I decided a couple of years ago, there's really no downside in doing like a heat acclimatization or heat acclimation. And so you might like, you're better off just doing it. Like there's no downside to it. And so, if somebody, either you can do the sauna, like you mentioned, just overdressing on rides, especially if you're doing a lot of rides indoors on your more like zone two rides, maybe don't turn on the fan and like just sweat a shit ton. If you do have the sauna, I mentioned that. And then you can also just like in a bath, like take a hot bath up to your neck, start like 20 minutes and build up to 40 minutes over the course of like 7 to 10 days. And it happens really quickly, like you said. So that could be something you're doing in the run into something like Unbound in those last 10 to 14 days.
Just don't do it when you have been out in 60 degrees after hiding from the sun for 6 months. And then the back of your legs are blisteringly sunburnt and you get in the bath and you have to like leap out because your skin can't take it. I tried that a couple of days ago.
Yeah. If you could see Maddie right now, he's quite red from his recent training camp in, I'm guessing, yeah, Arizona or New Mexico.
No, just Fort Collins.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Wow.
I've been hiding indoors, man.
Yeah. Well, no, and me too, right? It's like, it happens every year. And I like, especially when I was coaching runners, it's like all of a sudden I'd get emails from runners and they're like, oh, I feel like shit. I'm so slow. My heart rate's high. And it's like, and it takes, like, I guess that's would be a caveat here is like, if your race is still pretty far away, then you maybe don't need to do these heat acclimatization. You can just like, yeah, make an effort to ride in the heat of the day and really start to like ease yourself into it. But God, I want to say last year it was still pretty cold. Like
it was
maybe a month before June. And so, yeah, it's like, I was just like having to, one, I would overdress on every ride, and two, I started doing the bathtub protocol just because I was terrified of going to Kansas. And then, like you said, it was overcast. It was a perfect day, barely any wind. It was beautiful.
I might go there for my vacation.
Yeah. But like I said, no downside though, right? Like it probably still enhanced performance just by having extra plasma volume.
Even somehow it's seems to be one of those rare things in life without a huge trade-off the opposite direction.
Yeah. Unless like I would say, don't do it if you're like also trying to do a lot of quality training, because that's going to have
definitely
a huge impact.
Yeah. Definitely whacks you. Yeah. And it's kind of funny. Like my son's learning how to swim, which is fun, cause I get to watch this simulated to be drowning. But I was going the other day and I went in and it's a very humid, hot area. And I went in and I was supposed to ride after, and I'm sitting there and I just felt myself just slowly going down. And inwardly I was calculating, oh, like maybe I'll just turn it into a zone two ride. I just started like bargaining with myself. Maybe, oh, I think I'm going to take a nap. Maybe I'll just start sleeping at 3 o'clock. And then I got out into the regular air and it was, wow. You know, I'm back to training. It's intervals are on the menu, baby. So yeah, it has a huge effect. And, you know, talk about specificity in terms of heat and thermal regulation. This also counts when you're not on the bike. I see people at Unbound. I mean, the you know, the whole, what do they call it? Expo. Yeah, that's the word I'm searching for. It's fun to go to the expo. There's a lot to look at, but if it's super hot, you don't want to spend 4 or 5 hours, you know, wandering around in 90 degree heat the day before Unbound and think that it's not going to affect you. You want to hide.
Yeah.
You want to get away from it because you just added a lot of stress to your body that, yeah, it's not going to dissipate. So.
Yeah. And I think it's hard with something like that. And I would say like Ironmans are the same way in that they create this very like party atmosphere. And so you do want to walk around and it's like all the vendors are out there and everybody's hanging out and like they've got food trucks and like all this stuff. And
yeah,
I mean, and you've traveled and you've done all this stuff, but it's like, I would say if performance, it's fun to experience, but if performance is your goal, you're almost better off being a hermit. Like get there, get your packet, go home, sit in the air conditioning. Like
pretty much, cool,
you know, and it's hard. Like it's hard when you've going for the first time, you want to participate in everything. You want to walk around and try one of everything. But if performance is your goal, I would recommend like, yeah, just like sticking to what you know and staying out of the heat.
Yeah. Or get comfortable getting weird, buy an umbrella.
You know? I love that. The umbrella hat,
the umbrella shade. Yeah.
Yeah.
Another thing I wanted to mention in terms of specificity that I'll always try to drive home with athletes that I think is maybe a little bit more rare for people to address is logistical stress. I think a lot of people, because of metrics, things like watts per kilogram, they get really in their head and build this training utopia. Oh, I can do this on Zwift. I've been doing this in training. And so my performance will be this, but they discount all of the little minutiae that has to be done in a race to perform well, just showing up on time. For that reason, if any athlete has a big A goal, I always insist, please do at least one race beforehand.
I was just going to say, yeah, shake out the cobwebs.
It sounds trivial, but people showing up on time with their stuff. Yeah.
Two left shoes, wrong bike.
Yeah. Two left shoes, been there, done that. Yeah. You have to, I mean, it sounds silly, but I've seen people throw away, you know, what they must have spent $2,000. It's a big A race. They've been training for it forever. And then one little detail throws them off in a major way. And a lot of times it's because they just haven't done enough dress rehearsals. Racing is a skill, and part of that skill is mastering the logistics that support your ability to just get there so you have a chance to perform a representative effort for your fitness.
Right.
People just think, I'm fit. All I have to do is, I'm fit, I'll have a good result. Well, there's a lot that needs to happen, and a lot of it is just rinky-dink stuff. You know, for example, is my bike in good repair? Yeah, all that stuff.
Yeah. And as you're talking about that, one thing I was thinking about as I was preparing for this, podcast was, it really comes down to we are what we repeatedly do, right? It's just habits. It's building good habits. And I think you're right. It's like, we're rusty. You haven't raced in how many months. And so do you really want your first, A race to be your first race? And so I think it's really important to have that lower priority race where you can make all the mistakes and remember like, oh, that's right, I like to pack this, or this upsets my stomach. Like, because we can do it all in training. We can practice nutrition in training. We can practice all this stuff in training, but you get in a race, you're just going a little bit harder. You're taking a little bit more risk, things like that. And then what was working in training maybe doesn't work in the race. And so it's good to realize that before your A race.
Yeah. And I agree with you that we can replicate most things in training, but you don't necessarily know how you're going to feel when you're suddenly surrounded by hundreds of other people in this big vibe. And even that from a mental specificity standpoint, boy, does the imposter syndrome hit people hard then. And I think that's something that you have that often doesn't come up until you're there. And then a lot of athletes just feel like, I don't belong. And beyond wanting to absolutely strangle them, be like, what have we been doing for the past X months? What do you mean you don't belong? It, you know, it's a thing, you know? you always want assurances. You athletes always want guarantees. Not that I always like to quote this person, but they were saying, we as coaches, we can't guarantee success, but we can increase the odds. Yeah. And that's a big part of it. And having confidence in the work that you've done and not looking around too much and getting, just deciding to take a backseat immediately because of whatever you see or because you have some self-limiting beliefs with zero strategies, mental strategies to deal with them.
Yeah. And I think you just touched on another really important thing that I forgot to mention is not riding with people, right? Like, how important is that specificity if you've been doing all your training on Zwift over the winter and you haven't had a group ride? You
know? I just experienced that so hard. It was, you know, we're like 15 guys at this training camp I was at, and we, you know, we're just doing a pace line of different routes, and it took me two solid days to just feel cool, like not constantly like being jerky and wasting them. I probably, you know, had 40 extra like mini accelerations, like within a pace line that I wouldn't have had if I just touched my brakes in the correct way or was looking ahead more, you know, and was like in the flow of people. Those little things matter a lot.
Yeah. So let's talk about some other things for Unbound. So definitely I think the group rides are important. And like you just said, like it's a shit ton of people. Like, it's crazy when you get on that line and realize how many people are all starting at once. It can
be
overwhelming.
How many people ride bikes.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And so like, you don't want your first time being in a big group to be during the race. And so definitely like seek out some of the local group rides, or I mean, there's one here that I keep meaning to jump on. Like, they're doing group rides for like Ned Gravel. And then there's also the Gravel Donkeys, or like, and so look in your area, find out, like, if you don't like, I don't have any friends, so I need to find other groups that I can ride with. Right. And so if you don't have friends you can ride with, I'm sure there's a group or something, or even like doing a camp, I think can be really good. Even if it's not necessarily for the fitness, just to go and like experience some of the terrain and be with riding with people you don't know. We talked about the heat, that definitely matters. I guess let's, like, we talked about the position a little bit, so I'm just going to like bring it back to this one more time. I rode with TT bars last year, and because of that, I put them on my bike like 2 months before and was spending as much time as possible getting used to, when the wind hits me from the side, how is it navigating? When I'm like, can I be in the aero bars when I hit a soft patch of sand, stuff like that? Like, I think that really matters. If you don't have the aero bars, being in the drops, like, can you be there comfortably for 2 hours? You know? So that sort of thing. What are some of the other things that you see? And how many times have you done Unbound now?
Twice.
So this will be your third?
Yeah.
Okay. So what have you learned over those last two?
To your point, mostly to your point, well, my first hard lesson was hydration and sodium. That was probably the closest I've ever been to a real ambulance incident for me. That was pretty eye-opening. But the lesson that I keep coming back to, and I actually need to talk to you in after hours about setting up a appointment about this, is just the technical comfort in going 28 miles an hour down rickety terrain in a pace line for a long period of time. It's, you know, power is, having lots of fitness is nice, all this other stuff is great, you know, maximizing your aerodynamics is cool, all of it will help you, but this isn't a no draft race. Being in a, spending matches to get in a group that you can be in and contribute to means that you go faster with less energy in general. But you need to be comfortable enough to be close to the group. And while that's one thing on the road, at Unbound, that's definitely a skill. And I found myself climbing up, you know, basically frogging from group to group to group. And I finally got up toward, you know, closer to the sharp end, probably halfway in. And I eventually just had to back off because it was too stressful for me to ride in the group, you know, with one lane with dust in my eyes, barely being able to see. And I just thought I'm probably going to crash or take somebody out. So I'd much rather just kind of buddy up with, you know, one or two other people versus a conga line of 25. Because this is above my head. So I think at a race like Unbound, yeah, I mean, everybody's always talking about the fitness and little things, but especially in off-road racing, the technical aspect is such a huge performance driver. It's funny, like so most people on my team are much younger. I'm officially the dad of Team Brio, at roughly 35 years old, 36. I always learn all these new terms, and we were going down this one piece of gravel, brown pow, as the kids call it. And we're ripping through, and I was doing okay. And then I kind of lost my nerve a little bit. And then these other kids who are really good at cyclocross just came into a corner, kind of chopped me and just whooshed through it. And at the end, they're like, "Gravel God, what happened back there?" Blah, you know, giving me hell. And he's like, "Gravel God, you got to learn how to get swaggy." I'm like, "Get swaggy." They're like, "Yeah, you got to get your swag out. You got to learn how to swag, bro." Now, A, I'm not their bro. B, I'm never going to use the word swaggy in real life. However, I think the lesson we can take from that is they are really good technically. And you know what? Over the course of this 5 or 6 mile downhill, they put 45 seconds into me. And it wasn't because of pedaling.
Right.
It was free speed, more comfort. You could argue, oh, that increases the chance of risk. But I think in general, especially in gravel racing, it's more about just technical ability. You're not going to go out. You're not in Moab. You're not going to go off a canyon and fall to your death. Just basic skills will just make you faster. And the real bonus of all this is if it helps you stay in a group or break less, you know, stop using your fear finger, you will spend less energy. And energy is ultimately incredibly precious at Unbound. You know, spend the least amount of calories to go as fast as possible. Well, you're sure making your life harder if you're death gripping the brakes constantly or constantly getting spit out of groups because you can't comfortably just take a little draft.
Right. And I'll add to that too, like having the skills a lot of times, like, and this isn't happening at the pointy end, I'm sure not like nearly as much, but in the mid pack and beyond, all of a sudden with those water bars, you'll have like huge, like bottlenecks because everybody freaks out and has no idea how to ride through that stuff or whatever. And so it's like, if you have those skills, you can like pick a line and like pass like 30 people in a go, as long if you can stay on your bike while everybody's like hiking through water and stuff like that. And so, yeah, I think like in my experience with off-road cycling and probably on-road cycling too, it's like we all have our limits. And when we're racing, we want to be right at the edge of the limits. But like you said, with gravel, if you have good foundation and good fundamentals, then really like you can push it quite a bit. Like the only time you're really risking it is maybe in like some really loose corners and stuff like that at high speeds. But like for the most part, like you said, like going down like a flat that's really rutted out and stuff.
Yeah.
Like if you have good fundamentals, like you can bomb that pretty confidently. And it adds up, right? It's like, if you're getting 20 seconds here and 20 seconds there, if you're having to pedal really hard to catch back onto that group every time, you're going to blow up eventually.
I mean, it's the math on that is just insane. You know, if you're gaining, let's keep a conservative estimate. You gain 5 seconds every rolling hill because you're just bombing it, not death gripping. How many rolling hills are there in Unbound?
Yeah. Infinite. There are infinite hills.
Yeah, that's a lot of time. I don't want to forget, Dave. I know you maybe didn't want this to come in, I'm a firm believer in learning how to piss off the bike.
Well, no, I mean, that definitely like feeds into this is like, I guess we're getting out of specificity now, but like what are, let's call them marginal gains. But I think I don't see them as that marginal because they're pretty easy things you can do, like low investment, high return, and being able to piss while you're on the bike is huge if you're with a group, right? It, like you said, I mean, not only is there the aero advantage of being with a group, but there's also a mental advantage versus being by yourself out in the middle of nowhere, trying to push yourself along. And so like, if you're having to make a decision to stop to pee and the group doesn't want to stop with you, then you've lost your advantage. So that is certainly a skill to be practiced. I know that I used to try, and I, to this day, I can't do it. I mean, I've tried everything, like coasting downhill, standing up, like just too much pressure.
I'm kind of a big deal when it comes to that now. I didn't used to be.
So what's the secret? What's the trick?
Just, at first I just had to try to get like as relaxed as I possibly could and just refuse to, I mean, I probably flashed a lot of people while getting good at this, but just like refusing to back down. Like I will piss at some point. And so, I mean, to start off with, it was pretty comical because I was essentially, you know, just bibs, just junk flapping in the wind, just rolling down. I think it was Nelson, and, you know, got my hand on the left brake to make sure it goes slow. And I was just stubborn. I'm not going to stop until this happens. And I think I pretty much made it all the way from 36 to 63rd without doing it. And then it finally came. But then it was like a muscle and it got easier and easier and easier. And now I'm at the point where at Unbound last year, I didn't stop once to pee and I probably peed four times. And it was very simple. I would just wait till I was starting to go down a fairly tame downhill and then I'd whip it out. And by the time I got, you know, by the time I needed to start pedaling again, back in, ready to rock out. And it sounds stupid, but here's some basic logic for you. Moving is faster than not moving. And if you stop, get off, get the bibs off, maybe find a little bit of a spot, finally finish your business, get back on. We'll call that 2 minutes. So if I had to pee four times and I'm bound, there, I just saved myself 8 minutes. But as you pointed out, probably more because many times I would just drop to the back of whatever small group I was in, piss, hop back on, continue rotating. So I wasn't isolating myself either. So these things sound so, yes, this is kind of a joke, not a joke. It sounds trivial. But especially in road racing, I mean, the impetus to all this came because of an experience I had at Green Mountain Stage Race on the decisive day going in, like starting out, I had to pee and I stopped and it was, unfortunately it wasn't a quick thing. It wasn't 30 seconds. It was about 90. I counted because the final moto guy was sitting there. And I was peeing so long, he looked at me, he beeped his horn. He's like, what are you doing? Because everybody was out of sight and going down a slight downhill. And the only way I could get back on, I chased hard. That's another thing. I had to waste some matches. I chased hard for about 5 minutes. And then the moto guy came up alongside me and he gave me a little wink and he went like this. And I hopped on the back of his wheel and he pulled me at about 55 miles an hour down this slight downhill for 5 minutes. And then I caught back on. That's not always going to happen though.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, I don't think it's trivial at all. I mean, it definitely makes a huge difference, especially if you're like going for a result at a race. And I mean, like the example I'll bring up here, Steamboat Gravel last year. That was like all the drama on social media because people are in a group and two people wanted to stop and two other people didn't want to stop. And it like,
yeah. You know,
and so, yeah, it's like typically like if you're in a group, like it does have to be a group decision about when you're going to stop and stuff like that. And so if you make a unilateral decision, then you're also probably going to be riding unilaterally for a good portion of the race.
Yeah. It's nice not to have to rely on the goodwill of the gravel community to make a decision that could have a huge impact on placement.
Yeah. Yeah. So, So pissing was probably the most important thing here. And I just want to go back to you, you know, you said it took practice. And so it just goes back to what I said. It's all about like, we are what we repeatedly do. Right. And so if you want to get good at pissing off the bike, you got to practice.
You just got to practice pissing off the bike. Yep.
So, yeah. And risk, being incarcerated, being picked up by the cops.
Yeah. Organic intervals.
I just have to say that, the roads he's talking about, Nelson, goes by a couple of schools. So I probably wouldn't recommend like riding by schools with your junk hanging out, but maybe some county roads or something would be a better place to practice.
Let's just say I'm not allowed within a mile of those schools anymore.
Yeah, for good reason. So what other things, what have we missed? As far as,
well, we didn't talk about what bad specificity application looks like. I think that can be a big one.
Yeah. And I just want to mention this one because you're talking about application, but you started off by talking about Jim and how he'll go and look at the course and have it down and create a workout that perfectly mimics the course and stuff like that. In which I used to try to do, but I've been screwed multiple times by ride with GPS or something where the grades, you just can't pick everything up by a GPX route or by reading about it. Right. And the advantage that Jim had, he would actually fly there and be there and experience it versus
small advantage.
So I'm just curious where you stand. I know you said that, your coach has you doing some specific efforts because your chances are you're going to experience these efforts over the course of the race. Jim takes it to a point where it's this is the race, laid out interval by interval. So between the spectrum of zero specificity and flying to the race venue and laying out the race interval by interval, where do you fall on that spectrum?
I fall more in the middle. And I used to be far more on the gym side, so more specificity as much as possible. But one thing that sort of opened my eyes the past couple of years, but within my own performances, teammates' performances, athlete performances, is you have to have some faith in the human body to rise to the occasion on the day of. And there's a sort of a pitfall to specificity, which is trying to, you can't really replicate that ability too much. Your body only has so many of those, going above and beyond every year. And you really do want to reserve that for the event and not leave that in training. So an easy, obvious example is Unbound. I don't think it would be wise training to do a Unbound full gas simulation and consider that good training. I just don't think it's good training. I think it's too, for almost anybody who's not doing, training 30 or 40 hours a week. I think it's just too much stress and, right? Adaptation's in a Goldilocks zone. You sit on the couch, you get less fit. You break yourself, you get less fit. And that's why we split up intervals. That's why we don't train only one day a week. Because we give our chance the body to give our body the chance to recover. So I think it's far more productive weekend, for example, to do a 3-day block rather than one 10-hour ride really hard. But also, and this is more of a subjective thing, but back to the sort of training faith thing, I think you want to try to do some specificity. So for example, an Unbound simulation ride, you would probably do a couple hard intervals to start, just like you'd have at the start, because you want to get in a good group. You probably want to do, plenty of time up and around sweet spot. And you'd also want to spend a lot of time in the drops, making sure that you can comfortably maintain that hip angle, because you're just going to go a lot faster if you can get more aero. So that's good specificity, maybe it's a 5-6 hour ride. But you don't want to go so far that you're absolutely, crack yourself and then you can't do anything for 2 or 3 days. all because you have this insecurity about the process that you feel like you need to do this, you know, three times a year effort that you can only really do three times a year in order to be prepared. You need to believe in yourself more. And I think athletes who are in that Goldilocks zone and are really nailing it, they can perform. You wouldn't necessarily look at their Training Peaks calendar and look at their workouts and say, yeah, like this definitely guarantees they'll have an amazing performance. I think they in general do like pretty consistent good work, the fundamentals. They mostly nail what they have to do, but mentally and physically, they sort of reserve a big space to go to the race and then smash it. And especially in a data-driven world, you know, all the things we can simulate, I think a lot of athletes want, they don't want probabilities to increase. They want guarantees. And the trap is you try to, or the ironic trap is that you try to get a guarantee based on your training that ultimately screws them when it actually matters because they've got nothing left to give.
Yeah. So I want to add on to that because there's a couple things there. First, I agree. Like I think you can be too specific. And I think there's kind of two sides to that coin here. First, like you said, like if you're doing something really long and stressful, like Unbound, like do you need to ride the distance? Do you need to ride that intensity? Probably not. Like you can break it up, like you said. I am a fan of like riding the duration. And so that might mean if you're planning, or at least close to it, right? Like I did 14 hours last year. And so I think my longest ride was probably like 7 or 8 hours, like 7 or 8 one day and maybe 5 or 6 the next or something like that. And for me, that's really about just like getting used to how's my ass going to feel after being in the saddle for that long? How's my neck going to feel? How is, you know, what's my stomach going to do? Like things like that. So yeah, for really long races, I think, like you said, it can just be too stressful to try to replicate that race in its entirety. The other part of it that I'm not a fan of is that, like you said, you create this version of the race and get all these things in your head. And then all of a sudden you get out there and it's like, maybe it's a little bit windier. Maybe it's a little bit hotter. Maybe it's a little bit rockier or something. And it's not what you've prepared yourself for. And now you're like, you can't handle it. And so I'm like a little bit of a fan of like going in blind and kind of back to the whole ride with GPS thing, right? It's like, I've told athletes this, like, yeah, it's good to like pre-ride the course and stuff like that. But if you're riding it 2 months ahead of time and then you get there and all of a sudden it's rained or it's a lot more dry and dusty, like the terrain's just not the same anymore. And so you're not any more prepared than you would have been. So it's like, just pick out a few key sections if you want to experience those. But yeah, I think you can just set yourself up for like disappointment if you have this version of the race in your head and it doesn't meet your expectations on the day.
I love that idea. You're saying embrace, you have to embrace uncertainty.
Yeah. Yeah. That's racing. Right. And it's like,
yeah.
And that's, I just did a podcast, talking about like some of the most successful athletes are the ones that like figure out how to get it done, can deal with adversity and overcome it. And that's for these really long races. That's part of it. It's like, you're going to have mechanicals. You're going to have stuff that like, how do you move past it and keep moving forward? And so, yeah, I just think it's good to be a little bit on edge and like ready for what's coming at you versus too relaxed thinking that you've already done it.
Absolutely. As you point out, that's why you sign up. That's why people race. They don't just roll out their training logs and say, hey, can I get my finishing whatever? And that's the exciting part too. And it's also the chance for you to grow. I mean, I grew a lot the first time I did Unbound, that's for sure. I didn't think I could push through what I did. I don't wish to again.
Well,
but
I just want to add on to that. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but like you were talking about the skills part of it, right? And I'm just thinking about mountain bike now. There's no way that I could pre-ride every worse every mountain bike ride that I ever do. But what I learned over time is like, there's only so many different like terrains, right? And so it's like my goal when I'm coaching athletes is you want to experience those things. You want like dry and dusty, rooty and rocky, wet and slippery. Like, and once you do that, you're kind of building your resume so that when you encounter it blind, you can like call back on it and be like, oh, that's right. This is like this. I know how to ride this. Even though you've never seen it before, like you're still prepared for it. You still have these things in the back of your mind. And that's how I feel about something like Unbound too. It's like, you want to experience as many different types of gravel and different types of conditions, like wet and hot and all these things. And then whatever happens on the day, you're prepared for it versus preparing for one scenario.
Yeah. That's interesting. So you have these set of fundamentals, like we'll call them technical fundamentals. And, you know, maybe it rains and the mountain bike course is whatever, pretty challenging. But in general, if you've ridden enough in the wet, it's like, oh, this is basically how I adjust my fundamentals to navigate this.
Exactly. Yeah. Having like, you have those experiences and that, like I say, I call it like building your resume or whatever, because it's like the more experience you have, the more prepared you are to handle whatever's thrown at you versus riding your same route all the time and getting really good, being the local legend of that route and freaking out when it rains.
Yeah. And you know, to dovetail off that point, I think also, you know, when people talk about gravel, a lot of times it is the spirit of adventure, which can, you know, how much of its meaning has been lost or flattened, it's hard to say. But I do think making sure that some of your longer, you know, longer endurance rides just are kind of a little bit ill-planned. You know, you pick a different route. You know, you kind of put yourself in a little bit of a spot where you might have to figure it out a little bit. Because as you say, at Unbound, something will happen. And if your entire training experience has been mechanically, nutritionally, logistically, physically, everything, it's just all so dialed. And you never have to kind of call an audible. Like, you know, like an easy audible today would be, oh, I'm just going to take a little bit of a tour up into the foothills. I haven't checked the weather or, you know, seen what's snowy or what's not. A couple adventure rides do people really well. And I really see this with my, in a totally different sport, my ultra running friend. His ability to handle uncertainty is totally unmatched. Oh, like virtually nothing can faze him. I remember once we were going on an adventure run and we got lost. And we had like a fourth of a block of cheese. And it ended up being a 13-hour lost adventure. And I went through all the stages of denial and grief and bonking and freaking out and think you're going to die. And he was just steady the entire time. Because a ton of his training, because it's a lot of ultra training, is just like, this mountain looks cool. I'm going to go check it out for 8 hours.
Right.
And they get lost and da 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 da. And oh, I ran out of water. And so it's straddling that line of like totally dumb and ill prepared, but it's definitely his skill. And it's an important thing that allows him to thrive in these ultra long kind of adventure races. And a lot of gravel races want to bake that in. And it is baked in, you know, to the experience. So that's not really something to be underestimated. I'm struggling to think of a good way to prescribe that necessarily without just say, be dumb today and, you know, don't wear enough clothing or wear too much. Don't bring any food. Don't, you know, stuff like that.
Well, I think I don't know that you can be like, you can't really prescribe it, right? It's just, but I think as long as you're encouraging like those adventure rides, I love calling it that. That's a great way to say it, is like, yeah, go like check out new routes. Like there's a site called Gravel Maps. There's another one I found. I can't remember what it's called right now. There's another one called Gravel Bike Adventures. It's like, just like go ride a route you've never done before. And yeah, you want to go prepared for it, but chances are something's going to happen. I mean, I've run out of water lots of times. And like I did a route last year and on the map, it looked like a great route. And all of a sudden I'm like 6 hours in and having to hike my bike down because there was no way, like it was hard to hike down it, you know, and like ran out of water. And finally, like after having no water for 2 hours, like found a spot to like fill up a bottle and just having those adventures. Like it doesn't need to be, God, I can't think of the word right now, but you don't need to force it, I guess. So yeah. Let's finish up. You were going to talk about bad application of specificity, and we kind of went on that tangent of the like replicating the race. And so what are some other examples of that?
I think trying any sort of new to novel training stimulus very close is an obvious one, but I see it constantly. People do really well and they're very consistent. They nail the fundamentals all the way up. And then a couple of weeks before they start to realize this is going to happen. I'm going to show up. I'm not exactly where I want to be. I need guarantees. And then all of a sudden you start seeing, sometimes I'll see like 3 days in a row of VO2 or sudden announcements that they're radically changing their diet or they're switching bikes or, hey, I tried the 6 weight training routine to get more pop or
tires or a new bike fit. Like, oh, I've been riding the bike in this condition for the last 9 months. We're 4 weeks out. I went ahead and got a bike fit and they changed everything.
Radical Hail Marys at the death. And they almost always pay for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I agree with that 100%. And I call it fear-based training, right? Where it's like all of a sudden you get to that point and like you said, you can look back at your training peaks and you like part of training is having the confidence that you've put in the work and now like, it's just time to go out there and execute. Now, if you've been missing a lot of workouts and stuff like that, that might be a different, story, but it's like you do have to have faith and people do, especially if you start to taper and all of a sudden you start getting flat, heavy legs and you feel like you're pedaling through molasses and like people's tendency is to test it and to like on every ride, they want to make sure that they're still fit. They're still fast. And you end up like leaving the race out there on the course. And so, yeah, I think those last 3 to 4 weeks are when people, because your training load starts to come down, maybe you have more time on your hands, like more energy to start worrying about other things. And so all of a sudden, like people just, it's almost like busy work, like coming up with things to derail themselves.
Yeah. And I also think it's like the athletes that I see do best sort of a build to taper period. I would say more of a taper period, like final preparation phase. They probably have more things going on than just their sport. And I mean, things that they enjoy. Cause as you say, your hours, you tend to get a few hours back and that can go badly, especially like from two perspectives. One, if your sport is the only thing you really fill your time with. And two, if it's also the only, lots of people tend to ride as their only coping mechanism for life. And that it's like the same issue with, I can only eat if I train. It's like, oh no, you actually need to eat. Like regardless of your training, non-negotiable, but you get yourself in this spiral where, you know, you're training because you want to eat, but then you're getting more tired. So you're eating more and then you're training more and like you're training, you're not actually training anymore. You're just like creating a deficit and da da da, and you're screwing yourself and you're ruining your taper. And same thing with the stress aspect. Okay. Like this stresses you out, so you need to ride for it, but it's also like probably not addressing the root of the problem, just the symptom, or like preventing you from like getting another strategy to deal with it. And it's also in many cases, as you say, often combined with, I not only ride to deal with stress, but I also have to always be searching for answers in my rides. So then you're adding even more stress. So now it's not even just dissipating the stress, it's adding to the stress. And then if that goes badly, then there's even more stress.
Right.
So yeah. Yeah, it's, I think the taper is the easiest time I have coaching people is probably the build, because it's a lot and they can go hard. And
yeah, yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. Yeah. You're right. The prep stage, it's like, it's about being patient.
Yeah.
And people want all the sexy, I think it's really hard too. And again, we're going off on a tangent, but like if somebody just hires you and they've never worked with a coach before, they're all excited to work with the coach. And then it's like, okay, where's all these like super sexy workouts? It's like, yeah. They'll come eventually, you know, but yeah, that can be hard. Yeah. Any other examples of bad application of specificity?
I think I'm out.
All right.
Other than what I mentioned at the start, you know, a lot of athletes have a lot of interests, but this is what my coach says. So credit to Nate. You have, it's important to realize, to know yourself and what you actually want. So every year I beat the same drum and I say, God damn it. Why didn't I start doing more specific stuff in January, like a good roadie boy, and do my specific intervals and almost always ride? And he just says in his Nate way, yeah, but you like skiing though. And
that's so Nate.
And it's so true. And he's like, and he says, Maddie, like every year, you say this every year, like you always regret when it comes down to game time. Oh, I wish I would have done more specific stuff. But when it's January and it's the 14th day in a row, riding in your basement, you say, for the love of God and all that's holy, I need to go ski and get out of this house. Yeah. And you do, and you're happier for it. So like, if you want to be really fast, it's probable that, you know, more specificity will probably aid you with, you know, within a reasonable degree, but no matter how much of a cyborg you feel like you are, you also sometimes have to really like get in front of a mirror, like look at yourself and look at what you want to do and notice that. Like, what are you doing? What do you like doing?
Yeah.
And incorporate that into your approach, because you're a human being and it's, training can be fun. It can be type one fun. A lot of times it's type two. It's okay. And I think in particular, and you could probably agree with this, but like triathletes in particular, there's so much type two to what they do. It's never like, I love swimming so much or necessarily love running or biking so much. It's, I want to be fast. And it's okay to want to enjoy what you're doing sometimes. And I think in general, athletes that can find ways to have a training process that they actually enjoy will perform better and stick in it for the long run. Sometimes you do need to knuckle down, no question, if you want to be fast. And sometimes the work really is hard and sucks by like definition. But yeah, it's okay. It's okay to smile.
Yeah, no, I agree with that 100%. And it's like I said, I just did a podcast recently, and that was a lot of what we talked about, is like, goals matching, like a mismatch between goals and reality, and what you say you want versus what you actually want. And it's okay, right? Like you said, it's like, you're not getting paid to ride bikes. And so sometimes we have to like make that decision. And it's a conversation I have with athletes a lot. It's like, what are you willing to sacrifice for this? And nobody can answer that for you. Like, everybody has their line. And I mean, just as an example, my kind of threshold for riding in cold goes up a few degrees every year older I get, you know, like when I was in my 20s, I was like, yeah, I had no problem riding in like 20 degrees and like would tough it out. And, you know, and now I'm like, oh, it's less than 60. Nope. That's an indoor day. It's not that extreme, but it is it can be. And I think the other thing you mentioned too is super important. We're not machines, and motivation is such a huge part of this. And I always tell athletes, like, I would rather have somebody a little undertrained but excited to ride their bike been super fit and just like burned out.
Oh yeah. Every time.
Right. Yeah. And so I think it's important to have breaks, and especially like it can be a long winter, and so whatever keeps you excited through a long season. I mean, you started in what, November, and you're probably going to be going till like September, October. It's like, yeah. So whatever can keep you excited to ride your bike for 10 months a year, like take advantage.
Find it.
Yeah. Find a week it. Off the bike isn't going to hurt you probably. So
yeah. Taking a trip with your significant other mid season and late season is okay.
Exactly. Exactly. And, yeah. And I recommend it. Like I just had a bunch of athletes, they just did their first big race of the season. And it's like I always tell people, okay, now like this next week, just like take a mental break, do whatever you want, ride your bike, don't ride your bike. I don't care. Like you just need a mental break so that you can be excited for the next 6 months.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately it's hard to, there's no like, excitement power meter.
Right. Don't you think there is like the colored workouts and Training Peaks, like, if you're seeing a bunch of red workouts, or if people aren't leaving comments, or like that, to me is like the indicator of like the stoke meter is starting to get low and it's time to take a break.
That's part of it for me, but I think you can get somebody who has been doing it a long time, or like triathletes in particular, they can get like have an almost work relationship to it. So it's not like, how do I feel? It's like, I'm clocking in, I'm clocking out, which guarantees X. And that's hard to see, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But I think there are ways to, like, I guess for me, like the way I see it is in comments, in language, stuff like that. When people tell me, and I don't know if you ever use metrics in Training Peaks, but like keeping a tab on motivation. And yeah, it's okay. Mm. Every now and then to be demotivated or whatever is okay. But if I'm seeing it like 2 or 3 days in a row, like something's up. And so yeah. Like, I just always have that like clock running in my head as far as where I think people might be, and try to stay ahead of it. But yeah, I always say, like, if it starts feeling like a chore, it's time to reevaluate.
If you're to the point where you have a workout on the calendar, and the type 2 part of you is like, yeah, I'll do it, but you keep like procrastinating, you put your bibs on, you take your bibs off, anything like that, just stay home.
Yeah, right. Like, you're not in it anyway. Right. You're not mentally in that workout anyway, so you're better off probably just like recuperating that day. So
yeah,
anyway, so many tangents all the time. Thank you again for taking the time to be on this again. And I'm sure we'll come up with some more topics down the road if you're game.
My pleasure. Looking forward to the next time.
All right, man. Take care.